You might wonder, is it possible for my child with special needs to receive a rich classical Christian education? Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope answers yes. With the Simply Classical curriculum created by Cheryl and published by Memoria Press, there's no reason to withhold a beautiful education from any struggling student. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR. classicalspecialneeds.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. An interesting article in The Atlantic this week. Gay rights may come at the cost of religious freedom. Now, for the most part, I think the article kind of steers it down the middle, but it does come to the conclusion that there are a lot of unanswered questions when it comes to the assertion of homosexual rights and what appears to be the counter-assertion of religious freedom. Can the two coexist in American law and society? Joining to help us answer that question and explore some of the, complexities of the question itself and its answers, Dr. John Eastman, professor of law and community service at Chapman University in Orange, California, chairman of the board of the National Organization for Marriage. Dr. Eastman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Yeah, Todd, thanks for having me back on your show.
As things stand today, and especially post-Obergefell, can homosexual rights and religious freedom peacefully coexist in American law and society?
Well, you know, that depends on how tolerant the side that was victorious in Obergefell is going to be of people who hold a different view about the legitimacy and even the morality of homosexual conduct. If they don't are not tolerant of that view, if they're bent on discriminating against people who have sincerely held religious beliefs, then there's going to be a huge conflict, and there's going to be conflicts at lots of points of interaction in our society. We've already seen it starting, and you know, we can get into the various examples that are going on, but it's going to be pervasive, I believe.
All right, let's talk about some of the areas that where the conflict is actually kind of cropping up or where we're finding it. The first one I think that people, well, we can take them in any order, but I think the first one that people probably think of is the church being forced to do something it can't in good conscience do, namely to marry same-sex individuals. How real is that concern?
Well, people often claim that that's a silly concern and it'll never happen. In fact, it already has. There's a for-profit wedding chapel called The Hitching Post in Idaho that's run by a Christian minister. You can rent out the chapel for your weddings, but that comes with the minister performing the service. And he has now been hauled before the state Human Rights Commission for refusing to marry a same-sex couple. Not just to let the couple get married in his chapel, but to perform the service itself, because that's normally the part of his wedding service. So it is already hitting into the pulpit, into the sanctuary. The second thing we see a lot of is businesses that cater to weddings being forced to participate and help celebrate their wedding, photographers, bakeries, what have you. It's almost as the notion that we've changed the protection of religious freedom. You see the language being changed even to freedom to worship, which implies that it's only something you get to do on Sundays in your own church or in the privacy of your home, that the second you step out foot into the public square, you no longer have those religious protections. But for most Christian believers, of course, religion isn't something you leave at the church door. It's something that occupies you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It becomes part of how you live your life. And that's why these confrontations are occurring, because people are being compelled to live their lives in ways that violate their core religious beliefs.
What about workplace or hiring discrimination? It's one of the areas mentioned in the Atlantic piece. Where are the conflicts there, and how is it likely to resolve itself?
Well, I think we see two things going on there. One, there'll be conflicts. If I run a small operation and I don't want somebody who is openly engaging in homosexual conduct, in my business, because I think the conduct is immoral, just as if I didn't want somebody working for me who was openly and actively engaging in adulterous affairs. I wouldn't want that person working for me either. Well, adulterous affairs are not a protected class in federal law, so I don't have to hire that person and subject myself to an employment discrimination claim as a result. Neither is sexual orientation a protected classification in federal employment law. Until last week, when the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission unilaterally decided to add sexual orientation to the provisions of federal law as a regulation, even though for decades the left has been trying to get sexual orientation added to the federal employment discrimination statute, Title VII, and have been unsuccessful getting that through Congress. So yet another example of the executive branch taking matters into its own hand when it doesn't like its inability to get something properly through the political process.
So how significant would you say the EEOC's decision there, again, kind of just done without any authorization, how significant is it, and is it likely to stick?
Well, if we still live in a land with the rule of law prevailed, it would be completely unlikely to stick. There is no statutory authority for it. It claims that sexual orientation is actually a form of sex discrimination, which is covered by Title VII. But every single court in the country, save one minor lower court, every court in the country to look at the sexual orientation claims as matters of sex discrimination have rejected those claims. But now that EEOC has done this, and it's part of the new cause celeb of the day, I fully expect a lot of courts will just ignore what the law is and order that this be the new law of the land. Because the EEOC said so. It's like their boss over in the White House. He had a pen, he had a phone, and he can just do what he wants. And the bigger problem here is the utter lawlessness in which these agendas are being pushed through.
That's the tail wagging the dog. I mean, a classic example of the tail wagging the dog, isn't it?
Well, it is. Like I say, the statute that would amend Title VII to include sexual orientation as a protected class has been offered in Congress for years. It's ENDA is an acronym used, the End Discrimination. I forget what the full acronym stands for. But it has never passed Congress, and now the EEOC has just unilaterally implemented it on its own.
So one of the things that was highlighted with respect to this in the Atlantic article, even they admit, look, the problem here is things are highly ambiguous, and that we don't look to the EEOC for clarification. We look to our lawmakers and our courts for clarification. Is that part of the what it seems to be kind of law of the jungle thing we're dealing with right now on these issues?
Well, it does. I don't think there's anything ambiguous. It's the reason why people have proposed ENDA for 20 years or whatever it is. It's because the law is very unambiguous that sexual orientation is not a protected classification. EEOC's judgment here by 3-2 has no legal authority, therefore, and it ought not to be any less less unambiguous now than it was before. But there will be lower court judges who find that the EEOC language is now the governing law because they imposed it, and that's where the ambiguity comes from. It's hard to have clarity in the law when they're not sticking with what the law actually says, and they're just exercising raw will to do whatever they want.
What about spousal benefits? What's the issue here when it comes to homosexual rights and religious freedom?
Well, I suspect that given the Supreme Court's Obergefell decision that allows same-sex couples to be treated as married under state law, that whatever private employers benefits give to their married employees, they will be obligated to provide it here. However, federal law still doesn't require have sexual orientation as a protected class, and so they could say I'm giving benefits to my opposite sex married employees because I think opposite sex families perform a social good, public good in the creation of children that same sex couples simply do not, and I'm going to choose to subsidize that with how I provide benefits rather than other kinds of adult relationships. And I'm not the state government, and so the Supreme Court's Obergefell decision doesn't apply to me. That would be the right answer in my view, but I'm not certain that that will be upheld by the courts when they get a handle on that.
The other issue that's mentioned here is gay adoption. What are your thoughts there?
Well, look, there are a number of organizations, Catholic Charities leading among them, who for good reason, not just a religious faith, but for a very significant social science reason, choose not to place children into homosexual households. And they were ordered as a public accommodation in Massachusetts to do that or quit business, and they quit business. And so, you know, the harm that's going to flow here is that you're being now confronted with a terrible Hobson's choice if you're a religious organization providing adoption services. Get out of the business altogether and cease providing that unbelievably important service to significant numbers of people, or stay in the business and be forced to violate your sincerely held religious beliefs. That's a Hobson's choice that no private entity, particularly any religious entity, ought to be placed in this country, and yet they're being done so on the heels of this agenda-driven decision.
Dr. John Eastman is our guest. He's professor of law and community service at Chapman University in Orange, California. He'll be with us for another 10 minutes on the other side of the break. We're talking about the nexus of homosexual rights and religious freedom. You can join us with questions or comments, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Substitute Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com.
In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about homosexual rights and religious freedom. Dr. John Eastman is our guest. He's chairman of the board for the National Organization for Marriage. We'll post a link to the National Organization for Marriage at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Eastman, here is a subject that was immediately in the news after Obergefell, and that was whether or not state officials would give county clerks or other similar kind of state employees the option of not issuing same-sex marriage licenses. Tell us about that particular issue here.
Well, so we've got the issue on whether the government has any obligation to accommodate sincerely held religious beliefs of people who don't want to participate in conduct or ceremonies that for which they find contrary to their religious faith. So the comparison here would be to a public doctor or nurse in a public hospital paid for by the state. Somebody comes in and wants an abortion. Well, we give them an accommodation saying you can opt out of performing the abortion. That doesn't mean they have to resign, or it doesn't mean they have to quit performing all of their medical services, but they don't have to do the one particular thing that is offensive to their religious views. And so county clerks were taking the same position here. I don't want to resign, and I don't want to opt out of doing my job in marriage issuing marriage licenses, but I don't want to facilitate or participate in conduct that I believe is contrary to my religious faith. And normally, under federal law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and states that have the state RFRAs that do the same thing, the government can't impose on you that burden on your religion without a compelling interest. And if you're the only county clerk within 100 miles, I suppose they would have a compelling interest in forcing you to issue that license. But if there are other county clerks in the office, not to give you an accommodation when it's perfectly easy to do so would violate those RFRAs. Now, there are a number of states, probably about 15 or 20 of them, that don't have Religious Freedom Restoration Act protections at all. And it would be real interesting to see whether the First Amendment generally can be used to provide relief to those county clerks.
Then there is, and this is one that I think was glaringly obvious after Obergefell, where the battleground, the first, perhaps first shots in the battle might be fired, and that is sexual conduct policies at religiously founded universities and colleges. What are your thoughts there, Dr. Eastman?
Well, you know, the administration has made no bones about its position on this. The Solicitor General of the United States, Donald Verrilli, was asked point blank in the oral argument back in April, in a question by Justice Sam Alito, what about married dorm housing at a religious university? Will they be required to accept into their married student housing homosexual couples and therefore facilitate conduct that they think is contrary to their religious faith? And Donald really said, yeah, that's going to be a huge issue. And the threat there was that they would revoke the nonprofit status of any religious organization that engaged in that conduct or that it adhered to its religious views. And you know, that's, again, just another point of the many points of conflict that we're seeing between this radical gay rights agenda and religious liberty.
It sounds, kind of backing away from this a little bit, Dr. Eastman, as though I hope this is the case rather than the alternative, that the majority justices in Obergefell either didn't think these things through, all the implications, that would be charitable to them, or they did and they said, we'll deal with all those complications when they come up. What do you think it was?
Well, I think the most telling part of the opinions, Justice Alito specifically said these conflicts were going to be a serious threat to religious liberty. And Justice Kennedy's response in his majority opinion was not, no, they won't. It was, well, people can still believe what they want. Notice what he omitted there. The language of the First Amendment actually says free exercise of religion. It doesn't say freedom to believe whatever you want in the privacy of your homes or in the sanctity of your chapel. It's the freedom to exercise your religion. And what Justice Kennedy studiously avoided doing was saying that you'll remain free to exercise your religion. And so I think it's not just ambiguous, we'll deal with those when they come up. I don't think he has any intention of allowing a religious liberty claim to stop the juggernaut of homosexual conduct being recognized and compelled recognition throughout the land.
So all of these details remain to be sorted out. Are they going to all be sorted out in the courts?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, there'll be some legislatures that try to provide legislation, but that's going to require a little bit more courage on our legislators than we've seen in recent months and years. For example, the big controversy when Indiana tried to adopt a Religious Freedom Restoration Act that was identical in language to the federal statute and to those that are already in place in more than 30 states. But because this has now become a cause for the advancement of a pretty radical homosexual agenda that they were pilloried, and they immediately backed down, in fact, made things worse than they were had they just left the matter alone.
Do the advocates of the homosexual agenda, do they understand the what appears now to be the inevitable conflict between religious freedom? We know what Justice Kennedy thinks because he put it in writing in his opinion, but those who brought this to the Supreme Court, do they understand that there is now, by hook or crook, an inevitable conflict between these two liberties?
I think some understand it and see it as an unfortunate consequence of the what they call equal rights for homosexual, gay, and lesbian citizens. I think others fully understand it, and in fact, that's a benefit because in their candid moments, they've admitted that they want to destroy the church and they want to destroy the family, because both kind of serve as power bases in opposition to an expansive government. And so you see those conflicts being part of the game, part of the end game is to weaken the influence of the church, weaken the profound influence of the family on our culture and on civil society.
Is what happens if religious freedom is either chipped away at through these various issues, or attenuated to be Justice Anthony Kennedy's definition of religious freedom? What happens in our law and in our society going forward from that point?
Well, it's not much of a religious freedom if you just get to believe it in your mind, but you can't exercise it. Those that believe in God tend to have a higher regard for the commandments, and it requires us to exercise our religion, not just to hold a private thought about it. Just ask St. Thomas More. I mean, it would have been real easy if it was just, well, you continue to believe what you want. You just can't exercise it. that turned out not to be true. The second thing that's going on here, it's hard to predict, what consequences to society are going to flow from a weakening or even outright destruction of religious faith. But our founders were pretty prescient, and I suspect their predictions on this will bear out. And that is, it would be foolish to think we could have a self-governing republic if we didn't have reliance on morals of the citizenry and on religion. George Washington reminds us of that in his famous farewell address. But every one of the founders understood the importance of that. If you're not capable of governing yourself, that's kind of guiding yourself by the moral code, such as the codes that our revealed religion gives to us, then how can you possibly collectively expect to govern yourselves for the common good rather than your own base self-interest? So having that kind of moral virtue that comes from a heavy reliance on religion is a precondition for a successful self-governing Republican form of government. And that's what's at risk with these serious threats.
Dr. John Eastman is professor of law and community service at Chapman University in Orange, California, chairman of the board for the National Organization for Marriage. Dr. Eastman, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, and keep up the good work.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss the vocation of student. Dr. Corey Moss will be our guest. We'll also talk about sibling rivalries and conflicts with Drusha Mussman. She's a mother of seven. And we'll talk about blessings given by a prominent Catholic university to a faculty member who recently married his same-sex partner. Bob Laird of the Cardinal Newman Society will be our guest. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is an ebook. It's our very first ebook, Issues Etc. Book of the Month, and it's a great one. It's the Lutheran Service Book, a great hymnal from Concordia Publishing House. Everything you have in the hymnal that you can hold in your hands and page through, you have in the ebook edition of Lutheran Service Book. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org. You'll be able to carry your hymnal wherever you go, wherever your device will go. Your hymnal will go with you, and that will certainly expand the usefulness of that hymnal, not only in formal settings, but also in your home and your daily devotional life. Concordia Publishing House, give them a call, 1-800-325-3040, or check it out at our website, issuesetc.org, on every page of the website. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc., Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
The third commandment teaches us to remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. We do this when we hold God's word sacred and gladly hear and learn it. Jesus invites the weak and heavy laden to rest in him, our true rest, because his yoke is easy and his burden is light. This weekend, rest in Jesus as you hear his word and receive his gifts. If you are in Southern Illinois, you're invited to join Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt to rest in the grace of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Learn more at trinitymillstadt.org.
When the Apostle Paul stated, "I have become all things to all men," was he talking about fitting in with the world? I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled All Things to All Men. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues Etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. You can also read Pastor David Wan's story of failing to find Lutheran theology in several Lutheran churches, but finding it in Scripture and the Lutheran Confessions, the free online Issues Etc. journal.